the most important scientific and I think social issue that we are facing right now, right? Some of you, of course, I gather have been following the stuff I've been writing on my blog and in op-ed pieces. So on much of this stuff, I do have a definite opinion as to what can or cannot be done. And roughly the opinion is going to be proceed with caution. It's not an opinion that is going to say that you should not do gene editing at all. That's not my position. But I want to motivate the thinking of those who would want to ban it altogether right from the beginning by pointing out some of the problems that are associated with it. So what do I envision the future to be? At one end, let's look at some optimistic things. Probably all of you heard over the last few years ago about this disease called Zika that originally spread in Brazil, eventually all around the world. Several cases even happened in Texas, right? And so it's spread by a virus. Nobody really understands exactly why the disease arises when the virus spreads or not. At the time when Zika was spreading, people kind of laughed at me when I was quoted as saying, yeah, there's nothing we can do to control it right now, but within about 2 years, it will disappear, and then when we least expect it, it'll reappear 10 to 15 years from now, because the disease was spreading so rapidly. And sure enough, in 2 years, it's disappeared. You don't really have to worry about it now. I just realized, I found, as I had predicted, a friend of mine who just got pregnant, she was not even assigned one of those sheets that my wife was assigned to worry about the Zika virus and what might happen if you get infected while you're pregnant. And then if I'm right, it'll appear again in 10 years or so when we least expect it. How did I make this prediction? Entirely by looking at what the dynamics of the disease has been in the past. Ever since the 1960s, every 10 years or so, there's a burst of it, and then for whatever reason, it goes dormant again, but it's ready again in 10 years of time. We have no clue why that happens. The reason why this time it's spread around the world, earlier it had not, is because of increased travel, right? Zika was brought in went from place to place by planes, and just like measles now, Zika and risk of diseases like Zika are very much tied to increase in air travel volume. And unlike measles, we don't have a vaccine for Zika. There were several desperate attempts to develop it during the last crisis, and sure enough, you don't develop vaccines in 6 months. That's a silly hope. And sure enough, once the urgency passed, that stuff has slowed down. And unfortunately, I am going to make a pessimistic prediction. By the time it comes around in 10 years, the vaccine won't be there. Worse, nobody has successfully, right, so far, controlled the mosquito that spreads Zika. We know that because the same mosquito also spreads yellow fever, which has been contained through vaccination, right? And then it also spreads dengue, which is the fastest spreading insect-borne disease in the world. Everybody with me? Okay. So one thing we should be able to do, or we would be able to do technologically, if we had the political will to do it, is introduce a gene in Zika, in the mosquito Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, that will turn the entire population male. There are two reasons why that's particularly important for disease control. The most obvious one is that male mosquitoes don't bite you, right? Their diet consists entirely of nectar. The only time when mosquitoes bite mammals and take blood is when they have, whether either about to produce or about to lay eggs, and it's only the female mosquito that does that. If male mosquitoes then don't bite you, then they don't spread disease. Everybody with me? Even more importantly, a population of mosquitoes that's completely male will have some difficulty reproducing. It will go extinct within a generation, and the spread of the Zika virus through all of this, spread of the gene for maleness through the populations will take about three generations, right? By which, from first introduction, it'll spread through and extirpate a population. Yeah?
Sorry, this might be a little off track. But how come, since like Zika is transmitted through mosquitoes because of like the blood and these kind of things, how come like AIDS and other blood-borne diseases aren't transmitted to mosquitoes?
Well, lots of blood-borne diseases are transmitted to mosquito. There are about 30 of them or so. But the HIV and things like that actually go, and the concentration of the virus happens in your immune system and not in the circulatory system. Okay. The Ebola can't be transmitted for that reason, neither can thing. And then if some disease is very rapid, like Ebola is, the probability of insect-borne transmission decreases radically. All right? Now, why do I say that we couldn't do this? We can do this because of a new technology called CRISPR. That is going to dominate our discussions now. And the last outside speaker for this course is going to be Zach Adelman of Texas A&M, who is the one who established the gene system that can turn all Aedes mosquitoes male, right? And he has that. And he has grave qualms about releasing it and what the policy should be about releasing it, and that's what we'll talk about. And he and I fall on two sides of this debate. He errs too much on the side of saying that these should not be released because they're unsafe. I might be a little too optimistic of saying that really the problems that would cause are not severe. Having also been an ecologist for most of my career, I can safely say that mosquitoes disappearing is not going to do any significant harm to the ecosystem. And more importantly, we are not going to drive a species extinct by introducing this thing, because the species evolve responses to genes of this sort very rapidly. All we'll do is something that we would do by using chemical pesticides without the concomitant harm to the environment. Everybody with me? Okay, it's sort of one of those technology-driven solution to problems, like using nuclear power to prevent carbon production into the atmosphere. I tend to be optimistic about those. Other things about, so that's the end, that's the ecological disease end of infectious disease end of what we might be able to do with gene editing. And this technology should be ready within 5 years for deployment, should we choose to do so. And there are a few of us who keep on pressing to have the policy discussions that society as a whole needs to discuss about rules, about when we can use this and when we can't. It's one thing to say that when you have a mosquito that spreads diseases like Zika and dengue, for which we have no management, and so when we go after the population and may even risk extinction of a species, and it's another thing for you to come and say, we will put them into cockroaches because I simply don't like cockroaches. Okay? And where do we draw the line? Which of them can we take this risk with, and which of them cannot? And it cannot be an entirely subjective judgment. I mean, if it were left to me, I would probably introduce them to cats, right? But most people, because cats do so much environmental harm, especially to birds, but I'm sure there are plenty of you in this room that are horrified at the idea of my trying to drive cats extinct, and I freely agree I should not be allowed to drive cats extinct. Everybody with me? All right. Now, and that's the discussion we need to have. At the other end, for the first time again, so CRISPR, by the way, was the CRISPR mechanism, Cas9 mechanism, by which gene editing can be very efficiently carried out, only dates back, its discovery dates back to 2013. And it's only since 2015 that it looks good enough to use, and it's only now that it is beginning to be deployed systematically, right? At the other end, take human diseases. So you have some sort of, there are several diseases of the eye that occur because of genes being turned on in the eye that do harm. CRISPR can probably be used to, so at the one end you have gene drives, that's what we're talking about for versus pest species. And at the other end, we have gene editing. Okay. And at one end, CRISPR has already been used to edit genes for to make better tomatoes. Somebody's using CRISPR right now as I speak in one of the other laboratories across campus to try to have higher production in potatoes, all kinds of things. There has been CRISPR-based gene editing of pigs to increase the yield of pork. You produce pretty sorry-looking pigs, but they're fat. Okay, lots and lots of meat in them and all of that. And there are ethical questions there. I'm not trying to avoid them, even though the animal welfare questions that are raised by gene editing is beyond the scope of this class. I'll probably take that up in environmental ethics next semester. So there are other species, and then there are humans. And in humans, so using CRISPR, I begin to try to edit genes in the eye that prevent the genes in the eye that, if turned on, would do harm, right? And that sort of use of gene editing is called somatic gene therapy. And the main worry about it is, when is it effective? When are there side effects? When is it unsafe? But that is already permitted for a variety of genes now, and tests are underway, and there are no serious ethical issues there insofar as that why go for the genes is the most effective way of doing so. The important thing about this is let me remind you of Scott's book, that early in your development, your germline got segregated from your somatic cells. Everybody remembers this, right? The story of that. And so we are not touching the germlines. These edited genes will not go on to the next generation. This is like any old therapy where I go and modify cells of your body in order to control for disease. Everybody with me? Far profound issue comes up when we are going to touch the germline. We are going to go into embryos and use CRISPR in order to change particular genes. Probably all of you have heard of the fact that there has been a report of a doctor trained at Johns Hopkins in China who carried this out last year, right, on human embryos. Ever since then, he has been in a lot of trouble with the Chinese authorities, and some people, such as me, have been defending him in that context, that I don't think he should have done what he did, but there was no actual policy that he violated. The Chinese government invented policies post hoc after the event to satisfy his critics and arrest him, put him basically under house arrest. And it is the fault of the community as a whole. I'm a part of that community, and I've tried to do things differently a lot, is that there are no clear-cut ethical directives, right, policies, as you have in a variety of other medical situations, which tell you that you should not attempt germline gene therapy. Everybody with me? Okay. About 2 weeks ago, the president of the British Royal Society, of the US National Academy of Sciences, and the Chinese Academy of Sciences published a long piece saying that this should not be attempted right now at all. And then quite a few people, scientists and me, I wrote an op-ed piece in a publication for Congress called The Hill. We all argued that a complete ban was uncalled for, that the hope of this therapy is very high. Very good, and we should not just simply ban it without discussion. So what do I have in mind here? Think of diseases of the kind of like cystic fibrosis, right? Everybody with me? Controlled by a single gene dominant at the locus. Huntington's disease. Everybody with me and all of that? A few. There are about 30 or 40 of these. You happen to see it every time you begin to see it in an embryo. Correct the gene. Okay. Go in, snip, and put the right thing in. Yes, you're altering the genetic future of the population, but I do not think it a bad thing for human beings, right, to have the gene for Huntington's disease disappear in the population. Everybody with me? And all of that? And that's called germline gene therapy for removing disease genes. Okay? Now, lots and lots of people, including some of my closest collaborators, simply disagree with me. Okay? For example, Stuart Newman, with whom I'm writing a book, who is at the New York Medical School, is adamant that interfering with the germline of humanity, right, has the same moral standing as killing an embryo or something like that, that it is something we should never do under any circumstances. It should be inviolate. And we will look at those arguments. We're going to look at both sides of these, because I think there are important arguments on both sides, and I myself am not completely sure of my own motivations for suggesting that the research go ahead, that whether or not I genuinely am happy to see all of this happen, or whether I just think it's inevitable so we might as well prepare for it, or whether I'm just playing devil's advocate because I'm sick and tired of more and more restrictions being put without being thought out properly. I'm honestly not sure which of them I actually think. When I'm my public position is that we should not just by fiat ban all this research, because I do think, but I'm serious in saying that I think that removing disease genes, right, the genes that are clearly implicated in disease, right, should removing them from the human population is a good thing. Okay, everybody with me? But this is, I'm not going to impose any such view on you, obviously. This is something that is open to rational dispute. Now, the other end comes the idea that, well, you can also do germline things to enhance traits. You say some trait is desirable, and so you begin to encourage it in individuals, right? And all of that. And that's where we enter into really scary territory, okay? Okay, and that's one entire class will be devoted to the case of what are the arguments for and against human enhancement. There are a group of bioethicists led by some people at Oxford who think this is not only fine, but who actually think this should be encouraged. If you know that by changing a particular gene in your children, you are going to make them a little brighter, right, or a little stronger, it's your moral obligation, according to them, to go and do it, all right? At the other end, there are people like me who think that almost all of these worries about, or judgments about these traits that are desirable and that are not desirable are very, very politically and socially loaded, and I would not want those to be permitted at all. The example I use routinely, and I'm quite serious about this prediction, you allow genetic enhancement in some particular society, right, of what you want. In India, for example, my prediction is people will try to use it to lighten the color of the skins of their offspring. After all, that's the country with 1 billion people where they keep on buying skin whitening lotions and apply it all over them. They don't do any good, but it's a multi-billion dollar industry that happily lives on social prejudice, and that's what's going to happen in the Indian context. I use that as an example of why this whole thing scares me. Everybody with me? Okay. All right, we'll get there. So that's sort of what I'm laying out for the rest of the semester, and probably every single person in the room has some strong opinions about that, so this should be an interesting part of the part of the course. It's not as clear-cut as vaccination, and at the other end also, it is something that you are uniquely facing a problem that no other generation has seen before, when these are real possibilities, not things you can write about in philosophy classes, but is never likely to happen, ever brains in a vat kind of thing. That's not what this is. This is impending. It's out there. I could, if somebody gave me permission, it would cost me less than $4,000, even with my minimal skills, to carry out a CRISPR-based gene editing exercise on an embryo. That's how cheap this is. Everybody with me? Okay. Okay. It would marginally add to the cost of childbirth. That's where we can end up going. All right. Having said this, I want to go over some history, right, as to why we worry about this. And I like to say that this history comes with an awful warning. And if you're American, it should come with a particular warning for you because of what has happened in this society, right, with respect to it. And that's why we have to remember that we need to be very, very careful when we are playing around it. because nothing, so the 20th century, as I keep on emphasizing, was the century of genetics, okay? And genetics has never been, no other science has been misused, okay, in society as much as genetics has been. And let me try and explain this, all right? Okay, so two things emerge by the end of the 19th century, both a consequence of the discovery and acceptance initially of the theory of evolution, okay? One of them is a focus on heredity, okay? Darwin assumed, and it became clearer and clearer, that the way in which variation arose in species is due to weird physical laws that have nothing to do with natural selection or anything like that. Variation is blind. That's a term that's often used. The 20th century often says that there's random mutation or random variation. Now, out there, the point is that the environment does not play any direct role, right? So after Darwin and Wallace, who invented the theory of evolution, the most important evolution biologist was somebody whom almost none of you have ever heard of, Weizmann. How many of you have heard of Weizmann in one or the other of your classes? Well, you have, but you, yeah. Weizmann was pushed the strong Darwinian line that environmental effects cannot be inherited. Whatever his examples, his laboratory, he's a German, his laboratory example was he cut off the tails of mice for 17 generations and the mice still got born with tails, right? Everybody with me? And then he profoundly observed that Jews have been practicing circumcision for thousands of generations and yet they continue to be born with foreskins. Everybody with me? Okay. Whatever it is, just mutilation at the level of the somatic cells does not end up in it. And that's why Weizmann was the first person to formulate the distinction between germline and somatic cells. Everybody with me? Okay. And that applies to mammals, most animals, but to different degrees. And it does not apply to plants. Plants do not have a segregated germline. Everybody with me? Okay? And all of that. Now, so that was Weizmann was barely touching on what the rules of heredity will have to be. But really, exactly what the rules are were worked out by a monk working in what is now, what is it now? It's in the Czech Republic. Is it? Yes, it's in the Czech Republic. But it used to be, you could say Czechoslovakia, and now you have to remember which of those cities ended up in Slovakia and which ended up in Czech Republic. In a town called Brno, B-R-N-O, the monk's name was Mendel, and I'm sure that you're probably sick of me talking about Mendel by now, but he worked out the basic rules of genetics, right, over there and all of it. And Mendelian genetics says that genes get transmitted from generation to generation, and only they change only due to random mutation. The environment does not play any role at all, right? Now, so that's sort of the, and Mendelism gets rediscovered in the early 20th century, in 1900 as it is, and then gradually Mendelian genetics by the 1930s has become the dominant force of driving biology because there are so many traits in all kinds of organisms where you can just say that the trait arose because a particular gene was there. Everybody with me? Of course, this does not answer any of the more complicated traits, but there was sufficient number of traits, like the number of stripes in Drosophila, number of wings, things of that sort, that Mendelized in the appropriate fashion. So meanwhile, quite independent of Mendelian heredity and all of that, some of Darwin's followers began to wonder as to how, right, this new, whatever you've learned from this new evolutionary theory, how all that could be used to make the human species better, okay? And the move, and the person who was doing all that work, forcing it through, was Darwin's cousin, a man by the name of Galton, one of the most interesting characters in the history of science, or in history in general, right? And he invented a word and an associated pseudoscience, which he called eugenics, the science of human betterment by using evolutionary principles, okay? This goes back to the 1860s, right after The Origin of Species was published. Galton himself is probably most important as being the founder of modern statistics. Okay. He's the one who invented the concept of correlation and all of that, and following him, his disciple, Carl Pearson, formalized modern statistics. That's what he's most known for. He also was an explorer, went off and explored parts of Ethiopia for a while. Then he decided to go and live in the Ottoman Empire for 16 years and effectively became a Turk in all purposes, adopted the culture completely, dressed as a Turk, kept a harem, you name it. I mean, he was living as a noble of the Ottoman Empire. Then eventually he decides to go back to England. He goes back there, begins other kinds of experiments. Absolutely fascinating figure in terms of how many different things he did and what impact he had on different fields. He's the one who came up with the idea and then demonstrated that fingerprints could be used to identify human beings uniquely and establish that, which led to Mark Twain writing Pudd'nhead Wilson, right? And this famous diatribe against racial superiority. But so Galton, and Galton's program for eugenics, the other wonderful thing that Galton did, the kind of reasoning he indulged, see, he went through all the records of deaths, right, in Britain, and he looked at the age at which different professions died, and he then statistically showed that prayer was ineffective because parsons tend to die no later than any other profession. And given that they're more likely to be praying all the time for good health and talking to God every day, if prayer were effective, you would find some evidence there, right, that parsons were living longer or better or anything like that. There's no evidence. So Galton's wonderful scientific conclusion was prayer was not effective. But that's the kind of reasoning he liked to indulge in. He was willing to cross any boundary in the interest of numbers, right? And Galton's great idea now was that, well, he looked around society and he decided quite correctly on the basis of his statistics that lower classes in England had higher birth rates than higher classes. And he came up with called Galton's idiocy. He came to the conclusion that the unfit were breeding faster than the fit. And I call it Galton's idiocy is because by definition, that is nonsense, right? Because biological fitness is nothing about desirability, social desirability, or anything like that. Biological fitness simply is the expected number of offspring. And if you're breeding faster than some other group, you are fitter than members of the other group. Everybody with me? So saying that the unfit are breeding faster than the fit is just simply complete conceptual nonsense, but he indulges in that. And Galton's conclusion from his observation, the observation is right in the sense that lower classes had higher birth rates than upper classes, is that we should have, in a scientific way, encourage the upper classes to breed more. And he came up with all kinds of schemes, some of which have been tried in Singapore, that you offer monetary rewards for certain classes to breed, and you make it more expensive for certain classes to breed. Some of which sort of almost appear from the point of view of distributive justice, absolutely morbid, right? That you take the poorest section of society and make it even more expensive for them to have or raise children, and then you take the upper classes and offer money when they already have plenty of money to have children. Everybody with me? Okay. And of course, similar policies are now carried out are being encouraged in some European countries, where the Hungarians, for example, are encouraging, giving monetary incentives to certain people of Hungarian descent to have children, whereas anybody who comes from some other cultural group does not get the same incentive. At least Galton was not basing his stuff on race. He was basing it on class. If that makes you feel any better, Galton's somewhat better than what's happening in contemporary Hungary. All right. And this science we call eugenics, and one of the important things to remember about eugenics in the British context, right, is that at all stages it was supposed to be voluntary and encouraged, right, through incentives and stuff like that, and market incentives and others, but at no point was it supposed to become compulsory, right? where did the idea of making, well, the idea of making eugenics compulsory occurred in many other less democratic or less liberal societies than Britain. Where does it, was it implemented most effectively and most seriously? And that is the United States, okay? That is an aspect of the history of the country that we should keep in mind when we enter into all these discussions about using biology for social purposes, right? Anybody in the room? I suspect there isn't, but if there is, I would be delighted. Ever read Hitler's Mein Kampf? You can at least, yeah. You can at least bring it out of the library here and all of that, though when I asked a graduate student once to go and borrow it from the library for me, he just refused to be seen in campus walking with my Mein Kampf under his arm. So 1996, 97, I was living in Germany, and to just read Mein Kampf, because some of the things I'm about to tell you right now, that was the first time I'd heard about this, but I never read it. I wanted to read it. I had just learned to read German fluently, so I really did want to read it in German. So I tried to, and the book was banned in Germany. You could not get it, right? And so you had to go to special libraries to get it. So I applied for a pass to the State Library of Berlin to go in there and read Mein Kampf. And I would be taken into this room where there were guards outside the door, and then I'm almost locked in. And I had to sit in this high security room to read a book. It just struck me the most absurd thing in the world. In Germany, finally, Mein Kampf became available legally about 5 years ago, but it was banned for a long, long time. One of the great things about Mein Kampf, all right, one of the glaring things about Mein Kampf is Hitler comes out and he has two countries in the world he praises tremendously. One is Germany and the other is the United States, right? And the book goes on as to how Germany is going to become great, this, this, and this. Of course, the Jews are going to be massacred and all that sort of stuff. He doesn't quite say that. They're going to be removed and all of that. And the finally, every, and he was not that far off. No. Okay, everything. All right, everything would be decided by a massive global war, and the two sides that will be fighting for world domination would be Germany and the United States. And of course, at the end of Hitler's book, Germany would ultimately prevail and take over the world. That's just ordinary Hitler stuff, right? So why did he think so highly of the United States? The reason he thought so highly of the United States, because the United States had gotten one thing right already, which Germany had not, and that was involuntary sterilization of women that were considered unfit. Okay, these laws began to be passed in the US very, very early, at the beginning of the 20th century. When do you think the last woman, was sterilized against her will in the US? Yeah. 1980s, yeah. Yeah, and those laws remained in the book and were actually used all the way up to the 1980s. It's a long, long history of all of this, and one of the great moves in it, which I sometimes use, and I might have used in this class, I don't remember, was that the person who finally made this thing really legalized it, right? Forcible sterilization at the level of the Supreme Court, right? And this particular decision played the same role that Roe versus Wade played in the 1970s of actually legalizing abortion. The legalizing of forced sterilization was Oliver Wendell Holmes, who's supposed to be one of the liberal justices. And what he does is he takes up a case of Carrie Buck, a young woman, I've forgotten in which state, who had been sterilized because allegedly her mother, just like her, had been far too sexually active for their own good, right? And all of it, and were likely to have more children, and that these children would pass on traits that were supposed to be imbecile traits. And Justice Holmes concludes that three generations of imbeciles is enough. And then he goes on to argue the same rules by which society can demand that you get vaccinations also can let society force you to have a sterilization. Okay, so if you really want fodder for anti-vaccination rhetoric, the Wendell Holmes comparison of vaccination to sterilization should give you that fodder if you need it. But that was the decision that was made in the late 1920s, and sterilization happened all over the place. Very few states did not permit sterilization. Texas is one of them. Okay, but involuntary sterilization happened all over the place, and that is something that that was famous for. The assumption here was that certain traits were going to be inherited, right? These traits were harmful traits, and society would be better off if these traits were removed, right? And everybody who worries about germline modification now, right, even if it were to be carried out in order to get rid of disease genes, tries to keep that history in perspective. Holmes, Oliver Wendell Holmes, clearly did not think he was doing anything except furthering the social good when he wanted forced sterilization to take place. Everybody with me? And could it not be the case when somebody like me comes along and says, well, I am quite happy to see the gene from Huntington's disease removed from the population? Could I not be just as wrong as Oliver Wendell Holmes was in the 1920s? Everybody with me? And it's good to be, could be, to be quite careful about this and think a fair amount before you propose any policy, which is why I'm never quite sure when I'm proposing all of this to what extent I'm trying to force a debate and what extent am I really comfortable with this. Everybody with me? And the fact that I'm questioning that probably just itself is evidence that I'm not completely comfortable with it, and so be it. Sometimes when you are stepping into situations that require new kinds of moral judgments, it's good not to step out of, not to become too comfortable about your position too early. There is, of course, one huge difference between what was happening with forced sterilization and where we are now, right? One of them was with forced sterilization, we were in a situation where the individual is being forced to undergo it. All we are asking for now, those who are in favor of all of this, they're asking for now is that this be permitted but not required. So if you happen to be parents that are carrying an embryo, right, that has the gene for Huntington's disease, so you know one of you must also have it, which is bad enough, right? It's your choice whether or not to go and edit that gene, right? The effect of that will be that the gene, if all parents do this, the gene will disappear from the population. But not all parents may do this, but it's very hard to imagine a parent who may not choose to do this if they know the entire consequence of that, what the decision is, right? But nobody is requiring you to do this. So there's already one thing. Nobody in this debate in the United States, okay, or in Western Europe, is suggesting, or in Australia, India, any of these countries, nobody's quite sure what the situation is in China, Japan, Singapore, and areas like that. Nobody is suggesting that anything involuntary is done. The question here is sort of, is it permitted? And so the dispute becomes between those who would say germline modification is never permitted because we don't know, right? Yeah. And those who say that it should. Another argument that will be used, we're going to come back to this in some detail now. I'm just laying out what's going to happen for the rest of the semester, okay? Another issue that will come up, of course, is gross uncertainties, right? Yeah, we are removing this gene now, but who knows? Maybe there would have been some future benefit to keeping this gene in the population. Trouble with that is that, you know, yes, I can't imagine what it is. Meanwhile, I can see all the harm, and this imagined benefit should not trump known harm that will happen to this particular individual who might be born with muscular dystrophy or whatever, right? Everybody with me? Okay, so that's the kind of moral argument that goes on about it, and we'll spend some time going over those alternatives and see what we make of it. Okay, having said all of this, look, I have 10 minutes, and I'm going to take 10 minutes to summarize everything I want to say about the Human Genome Project before moving on to the details of CRISPR next time, okay? And that's what the schedule is, right? Yeah. Move on to the details about CRISPR next time, and you will need to, I think it is important for everybody in this room to have some clear idea of what the CRISPR mechanism is, what exactly it does, what it can do, and what it cannot do, because you are going to, how many of you have not heard about CRISPR before coming to this class? For how many of you it is new? Well, quite a few of you, it is new. I'm surprised, okay? Because CRISPR has been very much in the news for the last couple of years because of all the potential uses of it, including the use in China I mentioned to you before. Okay, where do all of this goes back? Well, it goes back to the Human Genome Project. Part of what was in the chapter I assigned you today, you've already seen in class before, a lot of it was. Especially the argument about what the medical benefit was and where we are with respect to medical benefits and all of it. And I probably end the chapter by saying, if anything finally medically really promising has come out of the Human Genome Project, right, then it probably is because of CRISPR. Maybe there will be a lot more medical benefits out of all these massive genome sequences in the future. I suspect there will. But right now, we don't have any. And in fact, had CRISPR not emerged, the CRISPR technology not emerged in the last 5 years, we would continue to say large-scale sequencing has not helped anything at all. Okay, so what happened? So one thing that happened, which was planned as part of the human genome sequence, the massive program to sequence the genome, is that techniques were devised for very fast sequencing of genes, right, of DNA. So much so that if you give me a reasonable, you just give me some of your DNA, I could probably extract from some cells on your body. All I'd probably have to do is to take a piece of cloth and rub it on your skin a bit, and that's enough to get cells, some skin cells, right, off you onto the cloth. I can take it in, have cleaved the cells, make the DNA, settle on a filter, remove the filter, dry it, right, purify it, and then amplify it using PCR in one morning. Okay, and if suddenly every sequencing machine in the city of Austin, now this, I mean, I might be stretching this a bit, but only a bit, sequencing machine in Austin gets dedicated to this task, I can probably have a reasonably complete sequence for you, not the last 10% or so, a reasonably complete sequence for you by the end of the day. I certainly could have it by the end of the week, okay? Compare this to a situation just about 25 years ago, when just sequencing one chromosome would earn you a PhD and would take you a couple of years. That's how fast sequencing has become, okay? We are rapidly getting to the situation where sequencing a particular nucleotide base in the sequence is going to cost you less than a cent, okay, in terms of how cheap it's going to become and all of that. And this has been coming. And in the period in the late 1990s, when the human sequence was just being finished, and then and in the early 2000s, people began to assemble huge numbers of sequences of bacteria and other things, right? And then they had also simultaneously, and developing these computational skills was as important to the Human Genome Project as actual sequencing techniques at the chemical level. People began to analyze these sequences over and over again and see what they find out about them, right? And what are the sort of things they find out? But one thing that I also already mentioned in class that was really, really surprising is how few actual genes human beings have. When the Human Genome Project started, the estimate was 100,000 genes, right? By 2000, when the first sequence came out, the estimate went down to about 30,000 genes. And now the estimate has gone down to about 22,000 genes, right? Barely 4,000 genes or 5,000 genes more than Drosophila, right? Rice has 60,000 genes, lot more genes than we do, and all kinds of things of that sort. Everybody with me? Okay. In fact, the number of genes seems to have no correlation whatsoever with the structural or behavioral complexity of the organism. What else did we discover? About 40 or so genes in us seem to have come to us from bacteria and all of that, so there is horizontal transfer of genes. As you probably know, 90% of the cells in your body are not human cells. even though most of the biomass is in human cells, and some of these other cells that live in your intestine and other internal organs, a lot of them on skin, in your skin, but the ones that live in your intestines and inside your body somehow manage to have transferred cells either directly or mediated by viruses into the human genome, right? There are a few hundred genes that are called orphan genes because there's no analog in other species. They seem to have arisen de novo in our species through gene conversion and a variety of other things. Everybody with me? Okay. And then, that's the human case. And then I told you, as with plants and things like that, a lot more complexity was discovered in terms of the number of genes. Of course, we also discovered that the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis that had driven so much of molecular biology is false. Okay. In humans, for example, roughly 2.5, between 2 and 3 enzymes or proteins are encoded by a single gene. And this happens because of what's called alternative splicing. When the RNA gets produced from the DNA, it gets edited in different ways to produce different versions of the messenger RNA, each of which produces a different gene. And the assumption now is, not proven, but probably correct, the assumption now is that at the protein level, we still remain richer and more complex than rice and things like that. One of the big differences here being is that there isn't that much alternative splicing of genes in rice. Okay. Now, as people were doing all these massive sequences and sequence comparisons, they began to notice something, right? In bacterial species, by about 1999, which they were finding more and more puzzling, that on a lot of species, there would occur these things where you would have small sections of DNA that were repeated over and over again, and each of the repeats was partly palindromic. Okay? What do I mean by that? That a palindrome, a perfect palindrome would be if I had TACCAG, I have CTGGTA. That's a palindrome, right? Why? What's occurring in sequence here, right? If I put it below here in the reverse direction, would by base pair complementarity attach to this? Everybody with me? Okay. So look at what would happen by base pair complementarity. If I couple this string in DNA, I would have A, T, G, G, T, C. Everybody see what I'm doing? Okay. Now this C has gone there. This T has gone there. This G has gone there. This G has gone there. This G, sorry, that T has gone there. And finally, this A has gone here. And that's what the palindrome is. Everybody with me? What they were finding was this was not perfect, but they were noticing this. And a big issue became, why? If you're seeing this kind of pattern, right, over and over again, presumably something functional is going on. You can't automatically assume that something functional is going on because we should know from a variety of results by now that there are many things that happen in biology that happen because of history, random changes and all of that, and not because of function. But that amount of repetition of a weird structure strongly suggests function is going around. Okay, let me stop here. That's a good place. I'll just take up here of noticing these repeats, and we're going to talk about how they become CRISPR-Cas9. So somebody was going to talk to me, one of the groups, right after class. Which ones are you?